This is The Lack with Nina Power and Benjamin Studebaker. Today we're doing The Land, and I will kick us off. The Land came out in Egypt in 1969, before premiering for the Western audience in 1970. It's set in the 1930s, when Egypt was a nominally independent kingdom, still under the influence of the British Empire. It's focused on an agricultural village. The villagers farm cotton, but for their cotton to grow, they need to irrigate their fields with water from the Nile. Generally, they get 10 days of water to ensure the survival of the crop. It's barely enough, but they scrape by. This year, however, the government has announced a policy change. Instead of 10 days, the villagers only get 5. This decision makes no sense to them. It is simply not possible to irrigate the fields in 5 days. Something must be wrong. Maybe the authorities aren't aware that this policy is unnatural. If the villagers follow it, they will all be ruined. Perhaps they should send someone to Cairo to petition the government. Or perhaps someone is deliberately trying to ruin them. Is it the British? Is it the king? Is it the governor? The bey? Or is it their mayor? If the policy is nefarious, they can't be sure who they can trust, and they can't prove the policy is nefarious, at least not without more information. But maybe it doesn't matter who specifically is to blame. Maybe they should just defy the policy and water the fields for 10 days. If they stay united, the government can't lock them all up. But that's the problem. They can't stay united. Some of the more pious villagers object to the idea that the government could be deliberately trying to sabotage them. It's disrespectful to accuse these officials without evidence. Others feel that they have to exhaust their legal options first, that they have to at least attempt a petition. So they find an educated man in the village, they have him draft a petition, they put him on a donkey, and send him to Cairo. Of course, he gets off the donkey once he reaches the train station. This is the sort of guy who is stuck between the worlds. He's way too educated for the village, but far too provincial for the capital. As the petition gets passed up the chain, it gets edited. Instead of asking for 10 days of irrigation, the petition now asks that a road be built to connect the village to Cairo. What's going on here? Well, as it turns out, the governor is building a villa, and he wants road access to the capital. The road will need to go through the land owned by the villagers. The road can be made to snake around a bit to protect a few villagers here and there who cooperate with the plan, but ultimately some of them will be ruined by it. The irrigation policy is really about pushing down land values to make it easier to get the road done. One educated man is stunned to discover the truth, but he's told that this will ultimately be good for the village. It will be urbanized. The farmers who lose out are necessary casualties on the route to modernity. Many villagers have, in recent years, abandoned the village to try out urban life, but unemployment in the cities is very high. Many of them never find jobs in the city. But since they've given up their land, there is nothing for them to do in the villages anymore either. As one of the men puts it to his son, they abandoned the land, so the land abandoned them. And yet this same man says to this same son that those who are continuing to farm cotton are digging their own graves. If you can't win by farming, and you can't win by moving to the city, what are you supposed to do? Well, you can make a corrupt deal with the authorities. As it turns out, that's precisely what this man has done. The thing is, it doesn't scale. The road can only avoid so many parcels, and there are only so many opportunities to profit from corrupt arrangements. The man who is bought off can sneer at everyone else for stupidly missing out on the opportunity, but he cannot in good faith argue that he is a viable economic model for the country. The corrupt guy has a son who has just finished primary school. The most beautiful girl in the village aggressively grooms him because she wants to live a luxurious life in the city. She flirts with him, and perhaps she even engages in sexual activity with him. There's a scene where she throws him to the ground and the camera cuts away. It's not as if there aren't more conventionally attractive young men around. There's a gallant fellow named Abdul Al-Hadi, who is very talented at fencing with sticks. He's good-looking and sincerely public-minded. He rescues a cow that falls down a mill, but she's not interested in him. because his gallantry will never bring her urban comforts. She'd much rather sexually harass this rich 10-year-old. The boy is clearly confused and unsure how to handle her. I've never seen anything quite like this on screen. The beautiful girl's father is deeply committed to the village. He resents her desire to leave. He plans to wed her to Abdul al-Hadi eventually. Abdul al-Hadi would like to tie the knot immediately, but the father delays. He knows this crisis is likely to turn violent. Abdul al-Hadi is precisely the sort of person who might end up dead. He'd rather keep his daughter's chastity intact until the crisis is resolved one way or the other. Together, the father and Abdul al-Hadi try to illegally water the fields. They are arrested and physically abused in prison. The father is an older man. They shave his mustache, and when he returns home, he is humiliated and downtrodden. To make matters worse, the village is put under martial law. Camel riders are sent to enforce a curfew, and they prevent the villagers from harvesting the cotton. The father remembers when he fought for Egypt's independence. They were all united then. Even when they were beaten and repressed, they stayed together. But in the intervening years, each man went his own way, and none remained committed to the cause. One man in the village went to work for the government. Another became a greedy merchant. He feels he himself has failed because he spent his life waiting for others to take up the cause. But what were they to do? Each had a family to feed. The other men in the village treat the father with utmost respect and admiration. But when he is not present, each makes his own arrangements. Only Abdul al-Hadi sticks to the father steadfastly. Sure enough, the road avoids the property of the other leading men in the village, but it goes straight through the father's land. As it turns out, the officer in charge of the camel riders was himself once a landowner. He took this job after he himself was forced off his land in similar circumstances. He sympathizes with the villagers. To give them time to harvest the crop, he has his men leave the village early, before additional government forces can arrive. The villagers know that the father is going to be in dire straits when all is said and done, and so they all go to his land to help him harvest his crop. He may lose his land, but perhaps he can use the proceeds from the last harvest to start over. Alas, it is not to be. While the villagers are harvesting the cotton, the government's relief force arrives. As soon as they see the guns, the villagers take off. This isn't their land. It's not their fight. This leaves Abdul al-Hadi to defend the father on his own. He is gallant, but he is surrounded and quickly dispatched. The father is knocked to the ground and tied to a horse. They drag him off his land as he desperately clings on to the dirt and branches, his arms slowly shredded to the bone. This is one of the great films. The antagonist is no single individual, but the fact of disunity itself. Our attempts to overcome disunity through language or through institutional mediation are insufficient. No matter the eloquence of the father's words, he can only unite the village in partial and fleeting ways. The attempts to connect the village to the central government, through the petition, through the road, through the governor and the mayor, only go far enough to create false hope that they might go further. The distance between the village and Cairo invites the villagers to imagine a better life awaits them in the city, where no jobs await them. Attempts to close this distance by building roads further mutilate the villages and those who live in them. It might seem obvious to us what is to be done. The villagers should unite to oppose the water rules. And yet that view is so naive and so far from what is possible in this situation, it is almost as ridiculous as the view that they should do nothing at all. I'm very excited to hear what Nina thinks of this film. I think it's extraordinarily rich. Let's see if she agrees.
Wow, my goodness. Can you hear me okay? Yeah. Sorry, producer. Yes, no, it is a great film. The opening scene and the final scene mirror each other very poignantly. I mean, it's a very tragic film as well. Like the opening scene is the kind of, let's say, the man who's loyal to the revolution, the noble man, is sort of touching the cotton plant where there's still water. And the final scene is him being dragged off, trying to grab onto the land, which is sort of disintegrating because it's dry and, you know, symbolically because they haven't been able to protect it. I mean, yeah, it's a very powerful film. It's interesting you talk about the sort of grooming scene, I suppose we would call it that now. But I was struck many things by well, the amount of times they strike each other. It's a very physical film, right? And there's a lot of physicality. There's a lot of kind of violence, but it's sort of lots of different kinds of violence, right? So, for example, if somebody speaks out of turn or if somebody is sort of being cheeky, you know, there's also the kind of playing with the sticks. It's the village is a kind of collective being that sort of keeps itself in check, but obviously is prey to these various forms of corruption, disloyalty, envy, pride, rivalry, all of these things that are sort of profoundly anthropological. Yes, I agree that it's really a question about the fidelity to the revolution. I wasn't sure at first when it was set, but then I realized that I thought it was set in the 60s, but it's obviously not set then. It's set in the 30s, and it's the midway between the kind of colonialism, well, the partial decolonialism, where I suppose Egypt is still a kind of mandate or still a kind of colony of sorts, and the and decolonialization proper. So you see the protests, for example, when the educated man goes to Cairo. There are people protesting, there are Egyptians protesting the British. And as you say, they're one of the possible blame, you know, objects of blame amongst many others. And indeed, it's hard to work out. And I think one of the tragic, I mean, it's a very socialist film. It's a very good film about the land and the reality. And I've been thinking a lot because it's spring about the importance of plants and trees and all of these things that, you know, in a way without them, we wouldn't be able to breathe, for example, but they're sort of not necessarily treated with any kind of reverence. And having grown up in the countryside surrounded by farms, there is a sense in which also I think in the virtual age, people often forget that food is actually made and that there are natural processes and things can go wrong. I mean, for example, you can have plagues. You know, we had Dutch elm disease, we had various animal plagues growing up, foot and mouth disease, CJD, and myxomatosis in the rabbits. We used to eat rabbits and these, or you have a bad harvest, you know, you the crops fail, or like here, and I think this is the hardest thing to take. It's the betrayal, of course, will always be of humans to each other. And there's all these kind of natural factors. But here, the object is so hard to pin down because it's kind of progress in inverted commas itself, or it's bureaucracy that's doing the evil, if you like, right? So you can't, the villagers can't point to a single cause, right? Is it the corrupt mayor? Is it the rich sort of, I don't know, local potentate, whatever his domain is, who wants to build his villa and build the road? Is it the government? Is it the British? But it's not. It's something much more amorphous and therefore much harder to fight, which is, on the one hand, the kind of incomprehensibility of bureaucracy, like the inadequacy of bureaucracy to live up to nature, right? And there are other films that deal with this, like Dogville actually is a very good one about how far you can push a political vision without kind of breaking the bounds of reality. But it's obviously the case that you can't simply mandate that the land behave in a different way or that nature behave in a different way simply because it fits your vision of the world or your schedule, right? So the idea of cutting from 10 irrigation from 10 days down to 5, you know, and there are glorious scenes when the peasants are deliberately irrigating the land, you know, and the water flows freely and it's, you know, it's very victorious scene, but it's not the final scene. It's the final scene is one of tragedy, but really there is this kind of deeper tragedy amidst all of the victory and the playfulness and so on, which is this kind of, yeah, impossibility of grasping so-called progress. You know, is progress the man building his villa? Is it the road? Is it the mandate? Is it the decolonial project? Is it Cairo? Is it the promise of emancipation for some of the women in luxury, or the fantasy of luxury, or the illusion of luxury? There's also a poor woman who is sort of treated very badly. And it's I, you know, perhaps she's selling sex. She's a peasant. She doesn't really have anywhere to live. She's kind of violently murdered at some point. And you know, the fate of women in this film is, you know, we have a very powerful female character in Wasifa, I think her name is, who is the daughter of the noble man. But yeah, she's very, well, she's looking out for her own interest. I'm not sure if she's necessarily grooming the 10-year-old boy, but I, you know, she's sort of using what she has, I suppose. But she does join the rebels, if you like, or she does join with the rest of the peasants and suggest that women can fight too. And I think, you know, so you have a kind of varying presentation or sort of polymorphous presentation of the possibilities of women too, right? Either stay poor and run the risk of severe violence, conform to various patriarchal norms, that there's various suggestions in the film that women must obey men, or be something else, which is this kind of revolutionary figure who's also perhaps sexually liberated, but not, you know, not a prostitute, but somebody who's trying to ascertain what she should do for herself, you know, perhaps without being guided by a man. So there's all of these sort of undercurrents, subversive, revolutionary undercurrents, as well as these kind of tragic things. And perhaps in that sense, it reminded me of Blue Collar, the Schrader film, which is also a film about disunity, corruption, a very different setting, obviously Detroit or car industry in America. But you have the same kinds of issues, really, about selfishness, looking out for number one, betrayal, whether one disobeys the law in order to enact crimes, to commit crime, as it were. But there are obviously some crimes are better than others, right? So breaking the laws that actually, you know, are themselves immoral, perhaps, in the name of a kind of worker, pro-worker revolutionary spirit is not the same as, you know, committing a crime that is both immoral and criminal, such as the murder in this film, which is also performed, I think, by this very strange sort of like charlatan religious figure. I didn't quite understand who this person was, but this is sort of odd, eccentric character who turns up at a certain point, or I suppose is maybe representative of an older kind of religion or magic, you know, this kind of almost like snake oil salesman, very, you know, strange character. Anyway, clearly not to be trusted. And I think the message of the film, yeah, is this tragic one about, well, there needs to be unity, but when the enemy is no longer identifiable, when it's no longer us fighting the British or us fighting, you know, I don't know, a particular mayor or us fighting some recognizable force, but rather peasants against progress or land against changes in the use of land, it's much, much, much harder and much more ambiguous and much more ambivalent, because it's also not clear at what point one says we should stop here, right? The fact that the peasants are growing cotton in this way, and that's what they've always done, and this is how irrigation works, you know, and they're using kind of primitive, to our mind, you know, primitive hoes to move that, to make the irrigation channels. They're picking cotton by hand. You know, when we think about progress, we often think about agricultural progress. We think about combine harvesters. We think about, you know, factory farming. We think about the mass production of food to feed the now billions of people that exist in the world. So it is both a kind of socialist film, but it is, I would say, open-ended as to this question of the sort of real abstraction, I suppose, of something like progress, or, you know, how things change and at what point we can say, well, they're not changing for the better, or we should stick with this, or, you know, maybe in the end, well, you know, one of the promises in the film to the villagers, to the peasants, is, well, you'll be part of, well, first of all, you have to get out of the way because this is what progress is, but ultimately you might benefit somehow, like a sort of trickle down, not just the irrigation, but a kind of, you know, oh, we'll bring you fresh water, they say at one point. You know, they have water, but they maybe they'll have an irrigation plant, you know, and the machine will do it for them. So no easy answers at all. And all of the, like I say, all of the deep problems of social life, you know, the complexity of living with others in a particularly in a state of transition, crisis, and so on. It's, you know, there's something very beautiful about the depiction of village life, but there's something also terrible about it too, because it's so easy to smash apart and all of these forces of and temptations and disloyalty are all there, you know, as they are always in social life.
Yeah. One of the things I really liked about this film is the depiction of the confusion about who or what is really the cause of the trouble. And I think this is the great underrated thing that I think even most theories of ideology don't really get at, the divisions that are created in by modern states and by industrial, fully developed or much more heavily developed capitalist systems make it really difficult for people to treat things as a straightforward capital versus labor sort of fight, or state versus society sort of fight. These divisions are really, really confusing. And it's not a purely, just that there's some ruling ideology that occludes it. It's genuinely the structure is confusing. And a lot of people do have double interests, double loyalties, reasons to go one way or the other, unclear interests that they have to suss out over the course of this film. The girl Wasifa, on the one hand, she has this loyalty to her father who is completely committed to village life and loves it and is never going to compromise or leave. And on the other hand, she wants to leave the village and become part of modernity. So which side is she on? She doesn't even know for most of the film. She's just pulled around by emotional experiences. If she sees people beating her father, then she'll be loyal to him. And if she sees a 10-year-old boy who could take her to the city, she'll try to sexually molest him. she's just pulled every which way.
Well, but I think she's very representative of precisely the reality of those paradoxes, you know, and we're all surrounded by images of different lives, and, you know, envy is a very powerful force. It's one of the most powerful forces there is. And if she thinks, well, I'm beautiful, which she is, I'm young, I'm beautiful, I'm eligible, you know, everyone in the village sort of fancies her. I don't really approve of her sort of attacking the young boy, but I suppose it's also played a little bit for laughs. It is slightly maybe shocking to to us to see that.
And the amazing thing about that scene is that after that encounter, there's maybe one more scene with the 10-year-old and then he's out of the film. You never see him again.
It's a bit strange. There is a sort of slightly strange subplot about the relatively middle class Egyptian boy. I'm not really sure what's going on with that. It's a bit odd because he's there at the beginning and you think he's going to be a character, you know, a relatively important character. Yes, there is that. But I suppose it's you know, this tension between the city. But you're right to note, and I was talking to somebody last night about enclosures, and she's a historian and a documentary filmmaker, and she was saying to me, well, one of the interesting things is that people in Britain don't think about enclosures as part of their own working class history, right? Because it's that they're seen as something so long ago, because obviously Britain sort of, you know, pioneered this sort of, or England pioneered this, what quickly spread. But this technique, or as it were, or this innovation. And there's a sense in which the working class don't necessarily think of any ancestral relation to the pre-enclosure ancestors, which is kind of interesting. I thought, you know, that there is a sense in which the working class has been dispossessed from the land for so long that there's no longer even any memory of belonging to the land or being part of the land, you know, and that this is that everyone is kind of deracinated. And I was saying, well, it's interesting, isn't it, that people are pinned down by their name, right? So you have all these different forms of enclosure in the sense of like the, you know, one is identifiable, one pays tax, one is a resident. And one of the things that I think the state has long been afraid of is not only self-sustaining or, you know, sustenance and sort of small-time farmers, but also forms of nomadism that are not trackable. And I think we had this in the 90s with the Criminal Justice Bill in Britain, which really everyone remembers because it had this ludicrous clause about repetitive beats because they wanted to ban raves. So they banned repetitive beats in public places, which is completely stupid. But really, if you read the bill, a lot of it is about nomadism and traveling. And what they really didn't want to do in retrospect was, well, they wanted to stop middle-class people dropping out and becoming nomadic, because really what you want to do is lock people down and put them into a financial bureaucratic mesh, right? And the obviously the original enclosures is you kick people off the land that they were using to sustain themselves. You create a working class and you also create the lumpen proletariat, some of whom, as you rightly note, we see in the film, the people who've tried to go to the city, who've given up their land, who tried to find work, who can't, who are basically at the mercy of whatever happens, I mean, mercy of fate, really. And but therefore they're extremely vulnerable to opportunistic employment, right, which would include perhaps turning on their own country folk. And you know, just to finish on this point, I mean, this thing about capital labor and trying to ascertain where the real locus of power is or who is pulling the strings, it reminds me of this amazing scene in The Sopranos where, if you think about the mob, the kind of shakedown of small businesses, you also see this in Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, but that where you still have this idea that you could, as the mob, go and sort of harass small businesses and you know, the protection racket, let's say. And they try to do it in New Jersey in some kind of chain store. And they're like, you know, you have to give us some money and we'll protect. And there's some sort of millennial worker who's like, I'm not sure who the boss is. Like, maybe I'll have to go and ask head office, you know, and there's just no way that they can do the same kind of thing because there are no small businesses anymore. It's all just these chain stores. And it's just an amazing scene about that kind of displacement of owner and the impossibility of, in a way, finding out who owns anything or where anything actually is, because power and capital is not located where you think it might be.
Yeah, and it's interesting because there are a couple of different ways that you can make things really unclear, right? One is to just have so many different layers in a hierarchical structure that everybody blames the layer above them. You know, if you come to them, you go, well, the person above me is making me do this. Or if the person above them comes to them, they go, the person below me is giving us a hard time and not cooperating with us. And so even in a system where ostensibly it's personal authority, personal power, you can, with layering, create confusion about where the problem really is in the hierarchical structure. Then you move to something that's more bureaucratic and technocratic, where there are appeals to notions of progress or modernity. And then that adds a whole another way of obscuring what's going on that's impersonal, that's very difficult to pin down and can't be attached to specific personalities. And in this particular case, you put those things together. You have this hierarchical kingdom structure that seems kind of traditional, but is very personal. You just, you know, you make a petition and you take it to the person who's further up the chain. It's very much like what you do in the Roman Empire, right? And then at the same time, you have these notions of bureaucratic or modern urbanization, progress, industrialization that are also going on. So when you have a the bay, the governor is able to say, well, I'm doing this because I want a road to my house, which is the personal explanation. He's just a greedy bastard who wants a road to his house. But then he also goes, but this will be good for all of you because it will modernize and urbanize your village. And that might be true, but they themselves, the landowners, they're not likely to have their lives become better as a consequence of that. Maybe the people who live in that particular spot will have better lives, but those people are probably not going to be any of the people who currently live there. The village might get modernized, but the people who currently live there will probably have to leave and go wander off somewhere else. And the possibility of invoking both of these things, a kind of personal logic and an impersonal logic at the same time, multiplies the confusion. And I've noticed this, like corporations are really good at this. Like if you are trying to get a promotion and you ask your boss, what do I have to do to get a promotion? Your boss can appeal to impersonal or personal logic, depending on which one favors not giving you the promotion, right? So your boss can say, well, you have all of the technical, qualifications for the job that's above you, but I need to see on a personal level that you're really competent, right? Or if you have displayed lots of competence, your boss can go, but you need some more years of experience technically before we're allowed to move you up to the next grade. So, give us a couple more years here and then we'll see. And this ability to play it both ways, or you need maybe a master's degree before you can go to this next level, because that would count as a prorated, years of experience or something. If you do the master's degree, we'll give you money. We'll pay for your master's degree. And they string you along by going back and forth between these different logics. And it's this ability to use both the mediation that existed in a kind of feudal system that's personal and based on ties, and the mediation that's bureaucratic and technocratic that comes out of modernity together that creates this abundance of confusion in this film.
No, I agree. And I mean, the idea of bringing the personal petition is, in the first place, is very understandable, but it is very naive. It is precisely based on this, personalist system where if you just go and speak to the higher up person, it's almost kind of monarchical or feudal, right? The idea that everyone's ties are ultimately personal and that there's a great chain of social being that leads up to God. And, then you have kings and aristocrats or whatever. And of course, that vision of the world is actually very tempting. I mean, we have figures like Curtis Yarvin, for example, who are monarchists of a very strange kind today, who think that CEOs should be like monarchs and that there should be like these little patchwork places which govern themselves. And, but there's a sort of charm to this vision, even though it's also sort of horribly California ideology and very techno. But you can
see, saw a little bit of this in Doubt when they, with the film that we watched last week about the nun, talking about the chain, use the chain. Mm. And I think what appeals to people who like this is that in principle, at each level, you have a lot of personal autonomy. You can do anything really, except that which would offend the person who's higher up the chain. You have total free reign, except if the chain is yanked.
Yeah. But also,
and that's what I think people who feel fenced in by bureaucracy like about that idea.
Yeah. So, no, I agree. I mean, but you see the kind of weirdness of this, almost the psychoanalytic aspect, when you have the idea of complaint, which is obviously Avital Ronell wrote this book about complaint in the wake of Me Too. And, that this kind of Kafka desire that somewhere someone will listen to you, like if I just keep going up the chain, someone will care about my complaint or my, offense or my harm, my hurt, and this is, I think this was somehow kind of implicitly sold to people as a reason to, I don't know, to keep going. I mean, this is my insane theory that why millennials don't commit suicide is because they've always got someone to complain to, and actually complaining keeps people alive because there's this fantasy that somewhere someone will listen to you.
Well, it's much easier to complain now because now you complain to the impersonal system, right? And then there's a set of impersonal rules that's supposed to somehow cut across those hierarchical divisions, right? If you make a sexual harassment complaint about your boss, it doesn't just go to your boss's boss and your boss's boss just decides whether to take it seriously or doesn't. It goes to some impersonal system that's supposed to somehow obviate the hierarchical difference between you and your boss and to adjudicate the claim as if you were equals, right? So even though on one level within the structure you're not equal, on another level you are equal.
Or and even depending on more powerful.
Or even fact. More powerful, depending on how the evidence and how that system works and how it takes into account the kind of evidence you're presenting. And so this creates really confused situations where in one of the systems that you're dealing with, the power relationship goes one way, and yet at the same time they go the other way in a different area. And then those worlds can be mixed in such a way that a person can feel confusion about whether they really do have power in the place where they think they're supposed to have it, right? So if your boss is concerned because your boss thinks that if you make a sexual harassment complaint, your boss will be disadvantaged in the adjudication mechanism, that might result in your boss being careful about bossing you, even within the domain in which your boss would be generally and ordinarily expected to boss you. And so you might reach a situation where your boss can't actually boss you. And then as a consequence of that, you'd have inefficiency in the system itself, right? But if you tried to, you know, obviate that by just doing a go up the chain thing, then you have the problem we talked about in doubt, where sometimes the people up the chain just won't even entertain certain kinds of complaints, just on the basis that they think it's not right or it's improper. And we saw a little bit of that in this film, where the more religious parts of the village wouldn't even entertain the suggestion that the mayor could be up to something or could be in on it or could be part of the problem. That's just impious to say those things when you don't have any evidence.
Mm-hmm. No, indeed. And it's interesting that, you know, we have new forms of complaint. You know, I mean, sexual harassment didn't even exist as a concept until like the 70s. You know what I mean? Like, there was no phrase, sexual harassment. I mean, it's not to say it wasn't happening, but these are relatively
recent. I think if Abdul al-Hadi had found her and that boy together, and he almost does, Abdul al-Hadi almost comes upon them in that scene. And I think if he had, something would have happened. He wouldn't have called it sexual harassment, but something would have been done.
Well, there's also a scene that I mean, maybe I misunderstood the scene, but it seems to be implying that one of the men is having sex with one of the donkeys. I don't know if you saw that scene. There is a kind of weird scene-like moment where...
There are a lot of stray moments in this film where things are implied that are quite astounding, and then you just move on from it, and it doesn't come up again, and it doesn't feature.
Well, and also, I mean, just the sheer level of physicality and violence, like I was saying, you know, not just the violence.
You can make a dozen different films about things that come up in this movie. That's why I said it's so rich in the opening talk. There's so many different things we could talk about here. I feel like we could do 3 hours on this movie.
I absolutely agree. And I think, you know, the depiction of women is very interesting. You know, the different kinds of women, the different postures that are possible for the women in the film.
Yeah, on that point, there's a bit where the woman who's eventually murdered, the poorer woman who's more on the outside, she's talking to Wasifa. And she says, you know, oh, you know, you've got Abdul al-Hadi all lined up. You know, everybody likes Abdul al-Hadi. He's the coolest. And the reason I remember his name is because this woman, every time she says Abdul al-Hadi's name, she says it like it's the most beautiful name that she's ever heard. And there's, you know, a bit where she's like chanting his name and dancing while saying his name. The women in the village are enchanted with Abdul al-Hadi. But Wasifa, who is the one who actually has his attention, isn't interested in him because she thinks that his gallantry and his traditional masculine qualities are of no use in the world in which we're entering.
I don't know. I get the feeling towards the end that she is interested in him and that she's constantly smiling whenever he's talking to her and he's asking, did you pray for me while I was in prison? Or, you know, I think it's more ambivalent. I think she's...
Well, he's trying to win her over, but I do think that one of the things that really sticks out about this film is that she shows a lot of interest in very traditionally non-masculine characters, like the 10-year-old and also a little bit the effendi, the educated guy. There's a little bit of that, too, where the educated guy is going, you know, I can do things. And other people who aren't educated, they can't do these things. And he's a really geeky, dorky looking guy. But he has a point, and she does seem to pay a little bit of attention to that argument. Certainly, she's willing to look at the 10-year-old. So, you know, I think if the educated guy had succeeded in helping and had actually gotten somewhere with that petition and had proven that he really did have an ability to get things done, she might have gravitated toward him. It's because of what happens to the father. He gets beaten and all of that and humiliated, that she comes back to the father's position. It's not because she really has learned that not to value the urban comforts, or she's really learned not to try to go to the city. Well, she's just pulled by family ties.
Yeah, but at least she's pulled by them. I mean, she could have run off to Cairo with the educated man or done all kinds of things, or sided with the government troops and begged them to take her away. Yeah, I think you're being too harsh on this on this one.
Well, the father also, the reason that he doesn't have Abdul al-Hadi wed her right away, even though Abdul al-Hadi asks multiple times, right? And each time the father goes, it's not time for that yet. It's not the right time. You know, what is it about the time that's not right? Abdul al-Hadi can't tell, but the father knows that Abdul al-Hadi is probably going to get whacked.
No.
Yeah, because he's precisely the kind of guy who 20 years ago during the independence movement would have joined up and would have been part of the violence and would have been highly likely to be killed. And in this kind of society, as soon as the daughter is married to him and they have, consummate the marriage, that the view in the village will be that she's been spoiled to some degree. And I think that's the reason why he delays over and over. And it's never made explicit. He never says exactly why he delays. So I could be wrong, but no, I do think that that's why. And then, of course, he does get whacked at the end of the film. So then, you know, isn't her position from the beginning of the film reasonable, that she should try to go with one of these new men who's going to hit it big in Cairo because that's where the future is? She's not entirely wrong to think that. It's not great, however, to pursue that at the level of a 10-year-old. The issue is that in the village, there's maybe two people who are young men who are unmarried, who might potentially have a life in the city. And it's the effendi, the guy who's sent on the donkey to do the petition, and that 10-year-old boy. Those are the only two people in the whole village who seem likely to get a proper education and to potentially have successful urban careers.
Benjamin, she's running out of time. She's limited options. You know, she's just covering her bases.
How would you have felt about it if the sexes were reversed in that scene?
I think there's a strange Clint Eastwood Western where he has a strange relationship at the beginning of the film with a like very, very young girl who's maybe 11 or something. And it's deeply weird and inappropriate, and particularly from our standpoint in which we do very much protect children from their own sexual desire and the sexual desire of adults. Although we somehow also treat them as adults in other ways, which is very dubious. Had it been an older man and a younger girl, sure. But I suppose part of the reason why it's relatively shocking in this film is because it's unusual to have it that way around. Like, we're well used to seeing older men lecture on younger girls. You know, generally pubescent girls rather than prepubescent girls. But yeah.
This boy is really young because he's not just 10. He's a boy who's 10. He's not a girl who's 10. He's really young looking.
Well, girls are still
girls. It's extreme.
Yes, I mean, I'm not quite sure whether it's... I don't know. I don't think the Egyptians at this point or in the making of the film or in the 30s have a different sexual morality particularly. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what's going on with that scene. What can we say about it? It's just a bit strange.
There's nothing quite like it.
No.
I've never seen anything quite like that scene.
No. I mean, like I say, there's Clint Eastwood scene, but I can't remember which film it is.
Does it go as far? Does Clint Eastwood, like, pin her and get on top of her?
He kind of asks to kiss her, or there's some sort of strange kissing scene with this girl. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of very, very exploitative films in the history of cinema. Let's be clear. And there are a lot of actresses and actors who have spoken about basically being treated badly and feeling bad about it. And, you know, acting used to be very close to prostitution. And, you know, everybody knows about the casting couch and Epstein and... Weinstein, sorry.
Well, many of those films have very sexually explicit scenes. This film doesn't have that. It just has a very, what it implies is very unsettling in that scene, I think.
Sure.
Not what's shown.
No.
I wouldn't say the little boy is sexually exploited in this film.
No.
He's just, there's a scene that implies things very heavily.
Actually, the closest scene to this I can remember, think of with an older woman and younger boys explicitly is the Makaveyev Sweet Movie, which has some very edgy and disturbing scenes with this character called Anna Planeta, who's like this witch figure who's very maternal, and she's giving sweets to these young boys, but she's basically kind of naked, and you can see the actual genuine confusion in the faces of the boys, and they're not acting. And it's very on the edge. And this was a very, very strange film. I mean, this is a film that like absolutely no one knew what to do with. It was a kind of a film about sugar and America and capitalism and liberalism. It's a very, very weird film, like highly, highly surreal, very bizarre, very grotesque, very explicit. Anyway, yeah, that's the only scene I can think of in other films I've seen that has that.
That sounds up there. With Sifa and the boy, for the audience's benefit, they're fully clothed in that scene. Nobody takes any clothes off.
No.
It's what's said, and then there's a pin, and then it cuts.
I mean, he says, oh, I bought you some perfume back from Cairo. And she's like, I think she says in the earlier scene, oh, if you were a few years younger, joking with her friend Kadra, I think is the name of the woman who is murdered. Is the boy traumatized in the film? I'm not sure. Is this?
Well, it's suggested that she's been doing this with him for years, that, you know,
really?
Years ago. Yeah, there's this bit where she suggests when they're sitting next to each other that years ago they were playing a game.
Oh, yeah,
that was
true.
This. It seems like she's been waiting for him to grow up for quite a long time. And he's trying to prove that he's there, that he's ready. You know, he's getting, what is it? His father is buying him grown-up clothes, he says at one point.
Long trousers.
Yeah, long trousers instead of short pants. Therefore, he's a man and he's ready.
What were the filmmakers trying to say? I don't know.
I think what they were trying to say is that things have gotten so desperate in the villages in
desperate
the 30s
times.
That the women who can see where things are going would rather date obviously ineligible men that you would never think of that they would pick, who have some shot at success in the city, than the traditional kind of man who would formerly have been thought of as the best man in the village.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that makes sense. Liz, we can explain it. That does make sense. And I suppose it's interesting that ultimately her father. Yeah. I mean, what does her father want for her? I mean, he wants her to be safe, obviously, and, you know, care for. But maybe she has to care for herself. I mean, the fact that she opts to join the revolutionaries, you know, she says, like, we'll bring the women. And the women are in the field, too, when the military or whoever come at the end, right? They're
picking
cotton.
They all take off as soon as the troops show up. None of them stay and fight and defend them.
Well, they don't have any guns or anything. Like, they're wearing these big black chadors.
Well,
like,
but they could have done, you know, the nonviolent civil resistance thing and have dared the troops to shoot them and all of that. But it's not their land, not their problem, so they're not going to go that far.
Well, the women, it is their land as well.
Well, it's surely. That particular parcel of land belongs to that family.
Right. Yeah. Okay, sure. But yeah, I mean, that's another question. Like, what is the relationship between the individual and the group or the individual and the village, right? Like, what is the village solidarity, if you like? It's, you know, every institution, every village is made up of people. This is the other terrible thing about bureaucracy, Like, of course, these structures exist. Of course, institutions exist. But they also are only ever made up of people. And this is the really terrible thing. Like, the more impersonal things appear to be. I mean, they are. But that's because systems have been put in place to stop them being personal. But they ultimately are, if you see what I mean. Just like violence is always human, even if it's conducted, mediated through machines.
Well, that kind of reminds me of the Etienne Balibar point about the possibility of returning to the powers of the citizen to constitute the structure, mm-hmm. right? The structure subjectivizes us up until the point at which we reconstitute it. And then if we reconstitute it, then all of a sudden we're agents again, and we're exercising the citizen side again in that account.
Yeah. No, sure. I mean, the citizen subject work, it's looking at the French Republic and that constitution in particular.
Yeah. You know, where the but I think you could kind of apply it here in the sense mm-hmm. that they feel completely dominated by the impersonal system. And yet it's, in some sense, they could, in principle, if they all united together, overcome it. You know, even modernity itself, like every time there's a meeting between one of the educated people or one of the village elites and the government officials make this point that modernity is inevitable and it's just going to happen. And you want to be someone who benefits rather than someone who doesn't. Come on, you're not stupid, right? That's the argument. But if everybody in the village refused to cooperate with it, it wouldn't happen if they all didn't cooperate with it, even though it has all this impersonal logic behind it. Yeah. Well, you say they'd all get shot, but the camel rider takes pity on them and leaves so that they can collect the cotton. There's a question if the whole village hung together. Well, they don't all get shot, right? Everybody runs away, and then just the father and Abdul al-Hadi get the crap beaten out of them.
You can't really see it ending well. I mean, it's a bit like the Battle of Algiers, you know, like they have the kind of ending and then they have the real ending, which is like, oh, well, actually, this went on for another 4 years and all these people were killed, the ones in the film. You know what I mean? Like, revolutionary...
But this is the thing. The revolution is a question, and it's a question for the guy with the gun of whether you follow the order to shoot. And until someone forces the soldier to make that decision, then, yeah, it seems obvious that the people in charge are going to be in charge. They're never going to win a straight fight with the army if the army is loyal to the people in charge. What they can do is they can stand together in such a way that they shake the consciences of the guys with the troops, guys with the guns, and those guys maybe do something else. And they, you know, clearly the camel rider guy sympathizes with them enough to leave early. So there, and a lot of people who have taken jobs in the military, in the officer corps, have done this because they've been forced off the land themselves. So they have a class solidarity reason to potentially side with the farmers. But it would only happen if they really thought that maybe that they could prevail. And the only way that they would think that maybe they could really prevail is if they all were united together. And as soon as some of them are running off, I mean, why would a soldier defy orders in a situation where there's only a couple of people in the village who seem serious about offering resistance?
Right, sure. But then in a slightly longer time frame, the invention of concrete and various farming machines will destroy all of this anyway, right?
Well, it will, unless, and this is the... This is the thing, you know, in principle, and this is the point Gandhi makes, if everybody says that using the spinning mill will ruin life, if everyone can see this, then everyone can refuse to cooperate with it. And if everybody were to refuse to cooperate with it, and this is something that I think is, this is always true. It doesn't matter very much, though, because it's never going to happen. If everybody were to refuse to cooperate with, you know, iron ore, you know, we wouldn't have iron ore. If everybody refused to mine bronze, we wouldn't have bronze. If everybody refused to farm the land because they think it's an undignified way to live, we'd all be hunter-gatherers. If everybody says no to something, it doesn't happen. The issue is that inevitably some people do say yes to these things.
Yeah.
And the processes by which people are made to say yes.
Well, indeed. And I mean, if you think about, like, colonialism itself, right? You have various civilizations, various countries that for whatever reason, the weather or whatever, have developed certain skills and certain techniques such as navigation and blah, blah, blah. and various mechanical processes and various techniques, and so are, in heavily inverted commas, more advanced than other civilizations and have better weapons, so to speak, better in heavily inverted commas, and are able to go to other parts of the world that don't have these things. And what are you going to do? Like, it's pretty difficult to meet those forces of progress, quote unquote, when you don't have anything to meet it with. It's like you are going to get bamboozled. You're going to get rolled over. You're going to get your stuff stolen. You know, people are not going to be nice about war and pillage and colonialism, and you know what I mean?
But this is because at some point people start to cooperate. At some point, after you inflict enough violence on the population, the remainder start to cooperate. If nobody cooperates and your choice is kill absolutely everybody who lives there, or stop, at a certain point, people do tend to stop. I do think there is something to this idea of nonviolent resistance. But for it to work, it has to be done at an incredible scale.
Right. But I mean, like, I don't know, if you're a Palestinian, like what is nonviolent resistance if you're a Palestinian currently when you're in a deeply asymmetrical war?
Well, I think the thing that, the story everybody talks about is there was this day where there was a nonviolent march and the Israeli military shot and killed a very large number of the demonstrators, and it didn't receive any international attention. This was, I think, in 2018, maybe. It was maybe 5 years ago now, 6 years ago. And, what happens is that after there's a bunch of people get shot, what tends to happen is that people give up on this because it's too horrifying and they stop. But the idea behind this kind of resistance is that it only works if you keep doing it. And that's the thing. Human beings have a very difficult time adopting a sufficiently religious attitude to do nonviolent civil resistance to its conclusion, because it means not just a willingness to die, but a willingness to die repeatedly over and over, and to see lots of other people die, and to keep getting killed over and over for the point until at some point somebody is moved by what's going on. And that would require not just one day of marching on the border and having 20,000 people killed. It would require many days of this, nonstop. And that requires a level of faith and confidence in what you're doing that people don't have anymore.
No, sure.
In general.
I mean, it reminds me of that. I think it's Bobby Sands' line, like, the laughter of our children will be our greatest revenge. You know, something like this, right? Like that you have to have an image of the future that might require several generations of people being killed in order to defend an idea, right?
Yeah, and that's what we lack. We don't have a vision of the future. So when people talk about these kinds of tactics, they strike us as ridiculous because we can't imagine believing in anything enough, even to allow ourselves to be killed, let alone to watch our neighbors and friends and loved ones do it for at large scale for a long period of time. And so instead, the logic of survival and the logic of competition becomes a kind of seemingly natural logic that we can't defuse. Because this point about, if it's just a question of who's got more power, then of course, whoever adapts the most advanced kind of technology will have more power. And if the deployment of that power can be used to intimidate and break up and divide people, then whoever's got the best tech will always win. And then all of human life is just a competition to have the best tech. And that's all it is. And it's just power to whoever has the best tech. The only thing that defeases that is some belief in values, and not just some belief in values, but enough belief in values that we're willing to be killed. And sometimes we're willing to be killed in struggles that involve putting a brake on that competitive struggle. Not just, not necessarily abolishing it or putting an end to it, but putting a brake on it, or at least governing it, managing it. And if we think that really everything is just an agonistic competitive struggle to have the best tech, then this is all you can get.
Yes. Well, let us hope that not everybody thinks like that all the time, and that those small number of people who do will be defeated by the larger number of people who have higher and greater and more communal values.
Or we can go into despair. Let's go to the B-side. Let's go to the B-side. Thank you guys so much for listening. Have a wonderful rest of the day. Bye-bye.
Bye.